Thank you, friends, and thank you again for joining us for this call for Spirited Action with Lewis Webb Jr. Thanks so much for joining us, Lewis. I'll do a little introduction, I suppose. Lewis is the Healing Justice Program Coordinator at AFSC's New York office. Been doing the work for a long time, done a lot of work with friends, and we're very excited to have you, Lewis.
Well, certainly my pleasure, and it's even more interesting not knowing who I'm talking to other than you, so thanks for not doing the introduction. That gives an aura of mystique to it. Good.
It is a mystery. Well, Lewis, I know that I sent out a video to folks who RSVP that you recommended that we watch, and I'm not sure if everyone was able to see it, but I don't know if you'd like to just kind of set the stage for what we're going to be discussing this evening.
Yeah, no, that's certainly my pleasure, and I apologize for only thinking of the video today, but I do appreciate your willingness to send it out, and hopefully one or two people, if not the entire number of people on the call, had a time to view it. But the bottom line here is that reentry, that process of leaving periods of incarceration and trying to reintegrate into the society, is a very unique challenge for people. And one of the things that those of us who are doing this work realize is that it has to be fixed. There are so many obstacles that people face when they come out of incarceration that the likelihood of them resorting back to criminal behavior just to survive becomes so great that, you know, we shouldn't be surprised when we look at recidivism rates in the 60%. So what I'm excited about is the opportunity to talk with those of us on the call this evening about what those challenges are, and clearly, more importantly, what Quakers and communities in general can do to mitigate these, in my opinion, injustices. So the video, I thought, was a very effective, short tool that kind of laid it out in a very pointed way. When someone is convicted of a crime in the United States, regardless of what state their conviction is, they are going to go through usually a period of incarceration, and then after having, quote-unquote, paid their debt to society, they reenter hoping to start afresh and have opportunities to live a fruitful life. And the truth of the matter is that ain't going to happen. So what I'd like to begin with is just to lay out some of the more obvious challenges to reentry. And I also want to make sure we understand what we're talking about is called in the industry collateral consequences, which means after I've been convicted or have accepted a plea of conviction, that's one consequence, right? That's the immediate consequence, incarceration labeled as a felon. But the truth of the matter is that the consequences go well beyond that. And some of the more pointed ones are the loss of the right to vote. In the United States, all but two states have some level of felon disenfranchisement. Those of us who are convicted of crimes in Maine and Vermont do not lose the right to vote at all. However, if you commit the same crime and have the same conviction in Florida, you lose the right to vote for the rest of your life. So across the country, depending on where you are, you're disenfranchised except for in Maine and Vermont from voting. All right? Mm-hmm. I'm sorry?
Oh, no, just it's a very striking figure.
Yeah, no, it's it. I think the numbers are, there are about 6.5 to 7 million American citizens who do not have the right to vote in this country because of some level of felon disenfranchisement. And whenever I'm talking to someone about that, I remind them of the 2000 presidential election when the margin of victory was based in Florida and very small. All estimates are if 20% of those who were disenfranchised in Florida had voted, we would have had a different president, right? And who knows what history would have, how history would have been rewritten. So felon disenfranchisement is certainly one of those collateral consequences. Some of the other obvious ones that I'm so sure people on the call have heard of or if not experienced are employment barriers, right? The infamous box that almost everyone has to check. Yes, if you have some level of felony conviction or even arrest in some instances if you're applying for a job. Right. There's a similar box for higher education. In many of the state, private, and local universities, during the application process, they have the right to ask you, do you have a criminal record? And if so, they have the right to ascertain details about that. If you are seeking housing, a private landlord certainly has the right to question you about your criminal background history. Public housing has the right to not only question you about your criminal history, but to also deny you housing or remove you from housing if you're living in housing with a criminal conviction. And it even goes further because if you're living with family, they have a right to evict the entire family if they house someone that has a certain type of criminal conviction. And then there are some of the less obvious ones. There's licensing restrictions. One of the more bizarre ones is you cannot be a barber in certain states if you have a criminal conviction. And we've all seen on TV or experienced directly that barbering is a trade that you are taught while you're incarcerated. So it's somewhat hypocritical that, yes, we can teach you, but we can't employ you or license you in that. So the real challenge is, how do we, people who care about issues, how do we help people who are reentering by mitigating or serving? Am I still on the call?
Oh, yep, you're still here. Oh,
okay, I'm hearing a lot of, I don't know if I pressed the wrong button sounds. Okay, so the real challenge is, how do we, if we are so inclined, help people reenter by mitigating or helping them circumvent some of these challenges? However, in my opinion, before we even begin to do that, I think the first thing we need to do is some reflection. I believe all advocacy starts by standing in front of the mirror. So I don't know if it's allowed during these calls, but I'm going to put out some questions, and I'd love to hear some thoughts of the people on the call to those questions. Is that okay, Greg?
That would be fabulous. And just if you would like to, that would be fabulous. And just a couple of reminders: if you're not muted, if you could please mute yourself, *6, *7 to unmute. And if you would like to comment, please remember to unmute yourself, pressing *7, and please introduce yourself and where you are located.
All right, that's great. Thank you. So the first question is, again, this is some self-reflection, because I do believe that you cannot advocate for something that you don't really believe in your heart, or you can try, but it won't be real successful, right? So you're a parent of a 17-year-old young lady who's a beginning that I want to go to college process, and she's applying to different schools, and she gets accepted to the school of her dreams. However, you learn that that school does not question applicants' criminal history background checks. So that means that there's a possibility that your daughter will be sitting in Chemistry 101 right next to someone who was released from prison a year ago for an assault charge and conviction. Are you okay with that? If not, I'd love to hear from you. And if you are okay with that, help me understand why we still have that level of challenge for people seeking public education, higher education, having to answer yes to, have you been convicted of a crime? Any thoughts?
Remember to unmute yourself.
Hi, this is John Adams from Atlanta Friends Meeting.
Hey, John.
And I do have a daughter, and I do have had the experience with my daughter and sons who have been in higher education and had to mentor other students who were convicted felons. And a lot of times I noticed that a sense of angst arriving around about the time when people are scrambling to pay fees and pay tuition, and sometimes sharing experiences with someone who, because of their record, was not able to get the grant money that was available to students who weren't convicted felons. And, you know, understanding that many of these young folk and people, period, from our community were, in fact, people who either they knew or they represented someone they knew and had made similar lifestyle decisions like having drug possession, smoking a joint, and getting caught and going to jail.
And your children survived that experience, right? They're okay?
Oh, yeah. Yes. They did survive it, and I think it made them better stewards of their community in the process. And it broadened the discussion around what the student population was for them.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Any other thoughts on that particular scenario, or...?
Yeah, this is Jonathan Betzal, University meeting in Seattle. Our meeting actually has two open, felons who completed their sentences and are now model members of the meeting. In fact, we're welcoming one of them to membership tomorrow night. Having them, their membership processes have really opened people's minds up to how these people are people who just made a mistake. So having them sit next to my daughter in class, hey, she's probably going to learn something from him or her.
I think you're absolutely right. I just wish the majority thought that way. It's so frustrating because it almost seems obvious that, this is not only fair, it's a unique learning opportunity, especially if you come from a community where you're not exposed to a very diverse population. The truth of the matter is, for 30 years, we've been incarcerating people at such numbers that, we've got to do something to afford them an opportunity to overcome the stigmas associated with, 30 years of mass, quote-unquote, over-incarceration. And it's so frustrating. But thank you both for that. I don't know if anyone on the call is a landlord or a property owner, but the next...
Hi.
Hi,
this is Free Palazzo in Atlanta.
Hey, Free. How are you?
Yeah, when I heard you were going to be on, I just couldn't resist.
Oh, goodness. Thank you for that. Well, I'm assuming you said you couldn't resist to get on the call. You weren't.
No, to listen to you.
Okay, go ahead.
You're very inspiring. I'd like to speak, having been a college professor, as to why it exists. And I'm not saying it's right. I've been working to help people come out of prison for 18 years here in Atlanta. So I'm well acquainted with all the problems you talk about. But I've had to try to understand them before I can change it, right?
Uh-huh.
Well, I taught at Alma College in Michigan, which is a liberal arts college that was north of the University of Michigan and north of Michigan State. And I never understood why people would spend so much money to send their children to a private school in a state that had those two really good public universities. And what I found out was that a lot of parents see college as a continuation of their children's education, but they want the schools to act as their parents and not as their educators. And so they spend a lot of money to put them in this very good school. And there were Africans there, but there were Africans from Africa. They didn't recruit African Americans or give them scholarships from Chicago or Detroit, which would have been a lot cheaper and easier to do, but they found upper middle-class families to go send their children to, the school in Alma. So that's when I think even in state universities we have this in parentis locus concept that the school acts as the parent.
Okay.
And that creates problems, like, for example, when we try to deal with the problem of rape on campus, even, that, they're an entity unto themselves. So that's a big problem, higher education. And maybe when we get free education, we all can go there and we don't have this problem.
Okay, maybe that's another call, Greg. Economic access to public education.
Thank you.
Okay. I was actually going to ask a similar question about tenants in your residential properties, but based on what I've heard from a couple of people who responded to the first one, I'm going to, if it's okay, Greg, switch up a little bit.
Sounds great.
Okay, and this one I actually am somewhat hesitant to bring up only because it has a lot of issues associated with it. But one of the more challenging reentry communities that those of us doing this work face are the people who have been convicted of sex offenses, right? Sex offenses. And we all know about registry and that lifelong scarlet letter that you carry with you if you have a sex-related offense, right? About 2 or 3 years ago, I think I was in Oklahoma, but I don't really remember. And I was talking to a meeting, and the topic came up about admitting someone into the membership who had a sex offender conviction. Not a typical reentry topic, but when you think about it in a more holistic way, it's really what we're talking about, right? And not surprised, but a little frustrated, there was a strong sense within the conversation that I'm not sure that we would be able to welcome someone into the meeting if we knew that they had that level of conviction. And, you know, the understandable response was, well, maybe we could let them in, but they couldn't be part of, excuse me if I don't use the right term. What is that time period when you work with the young people within the meeting? Is there a phrase for that?
Young friends?
No,
yeah,
it's actually
like Sunday school.
First day school. I call it Sunday school in my religious tradition, right? Okay, so, I mean, there was an understandable concern about, well, we couldn't have them around during that time, but maybe we could worship with them outside of the meeting house. And I'd love to hear from those of you on the call your thoughts on that very unique reentry issue.
Yes, University Meeting in Seattle has a lot of experience with that. It's been about 10 or 11 years that we've been working with a convicted sex offender who he went into a special diversion program after serving part of his sentence, or if he basically stayed clean and had some kind of spiritual affiliation, they would let him stay out of prison. So he had Quaker background, so we worked with him, and he's actually now after he completed his DOC, Department of Corrections obligations, he's actually now a candidate for membership in the meeting. But it was hard at first. There were a lot of fears about it. We realized at the time, however, that this was just a guy who was convicted. Who knew who else might be doing things that we had there was no public knowledge of it. So we needed to set up safety mechanisms anyway. So we did. Essentially, whenever we have a child care situation, there's always two adults on, and that creates a scheduling nightmare, but it's worse than having a problem, an offense problem. I'm sorry, it's better than having an offense problem, I meant to say. And that has, in fact, worked out really well.
Okay.
You know, the guy proved himself. You know, he really wanted to do right. And we could all see that. And that, as I said earlier, it just totally humanized the whole situation rather than having this abstract fear of what might happen.
Okay. And it's working out okay.
It certainly is. The guy's now one of the key people on our property committee, so things are definitely working well.
Okay, well, that is certainly good to hear.
Louis?
I think it's also good to hear it's not always perfect, so does anyone have any thoughts?
Yeah, Louis, this is Ann Francis, and I'm in Oberlin, Ohio, and I do have concerns about that very issue and how a meeting or an organization would be able to be supportive of a person. And I think that this would be an area where I would need more education about what is helpful, and you know, my experience working in shelters and with domestic violence issues and with sex offender people is it may be old school, but my understanding is that it doesn't always work out for people. They don't get the help they need, and so there are problems.
Okay, no, I appreciate that, and it's true that there are challenges that are very unique to that population that, you know, a term of incarceration doesn't solve, right?
Louis, I wonder if I might be able to jump in with a quick comment. This is Greg in Philadelphia, and although I haven't gone through any sort of process like this in a meeting and would certainly be open to going through that process with a meeting were it ever to arise, I did have a very eye-opening experience. I think one of the things about mass incarceration is how skewed our perception is from the start, and I was very fortunate to meet a woman who was a lawyer, a very passionate lawyer, who was working with people who were convicted for sex offenses when they were minors. And I don't know if people know this, but when you're convicted for a sex offense as a minor, at least, Louis, correct me if I'm wrong, in most states, if not all, that still stays with you for the rest of your life.
Oh, yeah.
So you have a lot of these, so you still have a lot of these situations where kids are getting arrested, you know, sexting or various things like that, convicted felonies, and then that's with them for the rest of their lives. And she was working with youth who, you know, have this hanging over their heads from the age of 15, 16. I think she mentioned someone as young as 14.
Wow.
So that just kind of opened my eyes to who we think of when we think of someone who's a convicted sex offender.
That's so true, because yes, say 14-year-old who's convicted of sexting or, you know, some not terribly heinous sex offense does wear that with him or her for the rest of their life. So yeah, we need to really understand who we're talking about. So thank you for that. Yeah, absolutely. Anyone else want to offer their thoughts? And please, I am more than willing to hear. You know what? We can't let them in. I understand that response. And so if that's where your head is right now, I think we would benefit from hearing your perspective. Okay. One of the related issues, and we can talk about some of the other collateral consequences as the call continues, but one of the other things, since it was brought up, at least in some context, about the attorneys and the people that are during that trial and plea bargaining process, there's always the question as to when someone accepts a plea, meaning that they don't go to trial, they accept, they take a guilty plea, usually to avoid a certain punishment. Should they be told of all of the collateral consequences that they are facing when they say, yes, I am guilty of this crime? And if they should be, whose obligation is it? You know, so you've got three parties. You've got four, technically. You've got a judge. Should he or she have the responsibility of saying, if you accept this plea, you're not going to vote, you're not going to get a job, you're not going to go to school? Should it be the defense attorney? Should it be the prosecutor? Or should the defendant have the responsibility to research his or her own potential collateral consequences before taking the plea? And this is a question that I'm on this call really seeking answers for, because no one has really convinced me one way or the other as to whose responsibility it is, but I do believe it's something that people should know before they accept guilty pleas. So any thoughts on whether or not someone should advise a person of all of these collateral consequences before they allow them to enter a plea? And if so, who should that be?
Hi, Free again.
Mm-hmm.
In Georgia, at least I found out in my county here in Douglas County, which is west of Atlanta, halfway to Alabama, I've heard that our public defenders often do not advocate for their clients. And it's a group of good old boys, including the judge and the district attorney, get together and decide what's going to happen. The people actually stay in jail until they agree to whatever they're offered.
Of course,
and we have a lot of people and this is not even prison. We're talking about jail. And then they end up pleading guilty just to get out, and it's really discouraging. So it's very insidious, and we have a one-party state, pretty much, and even at the local level. So we're about to change that here after 20 years of work, but it is really, I don't know how you do that. I really don't.
Okay, no, I appreciate that, and I think that's where most people are. We don't know the answer to that yet. Any other thoughts? Okay. The last collateral consequence that I'd like to at least get some thoughts on before we talk about what you can do as what people of faith can do to help in this reentry process is the one that, in my opinion, is the most egregious of all, and I think it's the one I started with, and that is the notion of losing the right to vote after a felony conviction, either for life or for a period of time, you know, while you're incarcerated, while you're on parole, whatever your state's mechanism is. And when I was convinced that that was work that I should spend some of my time with AFSC focusing on, I originally said, you know what, this is a problem for me because I am a big fan of the social contract, right? There is an obligation that we have if we live in a society to obey the laws of that society. And if you break that obligation, you know, certain rights associated with that relationship should be taken away other than, you know, liberty for a period of time. So I have, and on some level, still continue to struggle with the notion of the social contract, and if you break it, should you still be able to participate in the democratic process? I'm learning more and more that I was wrong, but I still have that in my somewhere in me that I don't allow to surface until I get home. Any thoughts on felon disenfranchisement, and you know specifically whether or not you should be able to participate in the democratic process once you've been found guilty of violating that contract?
And just as a note, it's great to hear these very experienced voices on the call. We definitely need your wisdom, and it'd be great to hear from some folks who haven't spoken up yet and would like to chime in.
Hi, my name is Karen. I'm from Portland, Oregon, Multnomah Friends Meeting. I'm going to just dive in because I feel so conflicted.
I appreciate that, yeah.
Yeah, I feel, well, what I, for me, is the core of the problem is that in many ways, instead of you're innocent until proven guilty, it's almost that because of mass incarceration, I look at the prison population and there's a part of me that says, is this person really innocent? Because people get railroaded into this legal system. And if you're poor and you're, especially if you're black, the level of discrimination is horrible. And my trust in the system is minimal. And years and years ago, I was on a defense committee for three Black Liberation Army members.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah, they were convicted of shooting a bank guard. Mm-hmm. And he didn't die, thank God, but they got 25 years. And I had some sympathy for these people, not that I believed that violence was any solution, but I understood why these young men would be so frustrated and so angry at a system that was so cruel. And what they saw was that the violence against African American people was so extreme that their people were dying, and they saw themselves as an army trying to fight that. And, yeah, so if it were those three people whom I knew personally because of the defense committee work, the legal defense committee, I'd say, oh, yes, they should vote. Unfortunately, we also have a certain percentage of the population who are sociopaths, you know, it's so confusing. There's the economic crimes, the disadvantages, the levels of assault, you can just shove someone and be convicted of assault if you're not the right color and if you don't have the right lawyers. Just shove. You know, so I don't know if we had an ideal system, each case would be judged individually. And that person, if the person is basically a benign person who got trapped in a horrible system, they would have all of the rights possible. But yet there's a part of me that says, I just don't believe in condemning an entire population of people who had the label assault or, quote, violent felon.
Right.
Yeah, it's just mind-bogglingly complex, and I don't have any simple answers, so that's all I have to offer.
I appreciate your willingness to share that, and being conflicted is okay.
Hi, I'm Ellen from Pennsylvania, Swarthmore Friends Meeting.
Hi.
And I just wanted to say that I feel that people who were convicted felons and served their time and then come back to the general population should absolutely be able to vote and be encouraged to vote. And I think that because there's such structural violence in the way our so-called justice system works now, that I think there's a lot of incentive for people who have been in that system to lose a sense of democratic process, to lose a sense of what democracy is about and the sense that their vote matters. And so to me, to make certain that people don't lose that voting right, that to me is a basic part of what it means to be a citizen, is to be able to vote. And if people have, you know, if they've done something wrong and they've, or, you know, and sometimes they haven't and they're still in the incarceration system. But there's a person at Yale named Vesla Weaver who's done a lot of work on how a lot of our young people are so disinvested in our democratic system. And so I just really believe that emphasizing the power to vote and the importance of voting is very, very important. I feel deeply about that. Thank you.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
And could I say something? Can you hear me?
I can, yeah.
Oh, I live in Maryland. My name is Lorraine. And I also do support the rights for returning prisoners to be able to vote. Actually, my state is in the forefront because the legislature passed that law in their last session of 2015. And it was vetoed by the governor, but it is, at the beginning of this session, it was immediately, the veto was overridden, at least by the House of Delegates, and the Senate set to vote next week. So I supported it at the time it happened, because the thing that is, it disenfranchises so many that are, it's a class distinction too, because the proportion of prisoners is so overwhelmingly poor and downtrodden and don't have their say in our halls of our government. And to encourage that is one big correction.
Okay. Yeah, this the issue of fellow disenfranchisement is the one that I have decided to put as much of the energy that my supervisors allow behind, because it's the one that I struggled with, so I realized that, you know, I identify as a relatively progressive, hopefully thoughtful person, and if I'm struggling with this fundamental right and the denial of it, I became convinced that there's a lot of other people like me, in addition to those who, for other reasons, want to take away the right to vote to various communities. So, you know, it's going to continue to be an uphill battle. There will be passes in various legislators that will be vetoed, and luckily Maryland was able to override it. I fear that most states either won't get that far or they won't certainly have the override numbers. So it's going to continue to be a challenge. Now, I know, Greg, we're about a little more than halfway through, and at some point we wanted to talk about what this community can do, right? Am I correct?
Well, that'd be great, but this conversation has been wonderful. No,
yeah, no,
right
I...
Here.
Yeah. An hour is a challenge for me. Not because it's too long. Okay, so I apologize if I'm allowing it to
go further than you want it,
but this is appreciated the opportunity. All right, so there are a couple of ways to approach this. The easy way is for me to give you a list of things that I think this community can do to help returning people coming home from periods of incarceration. But if I did that, I would lose so much of an opportunity to learn what's going on, because I have learned as I've engaged with Quakers and other communities of faith that, you know, you don't need the experts to tell you what needs to be done. So, you know, I'll be happy to share some of the things I've seen and some of the things that I know work to help with this reentry process. But I'd also love to hear from any of you who are either engaged in this effort or have heard about it and wanted to lift up some of the work you've seen. The one that I would like to start with is somewhat atypical, and it's an organization called Landing Strip, which fully understands the challenges of reentry associated with job and education and housing and all of the necessities. But what they've come to realize is that the other reentry challenge is just being welcomed back into the community and being afforded a space to kind of just meld back in, so to speak. So one of the more amazing things that I've seen is this organization spending time with people coming home. You know, not writing resumes, not doing job searches, not calling potential housing options, but just spending time, having a meal, helping them understand what the world is like. You know, you have people who are coming home after 20 to 30 years of incarceration, and we all know the world 30 years ago was very different. So one way that I think all communities of faith, and certainly the Quaker community, can do is to welcome. And welcome them just as you would a family member who had been away for a while, you know, serving the world in some peace organization on the other side of the world, and give them an opportunity to just feel like there's an opportunity to come home. There's an opportunity to find a community that will welcome me. It's not always about how do I pay my bills. It's, you know, how do I make friends? How do I understand the changes? Who's going to sit with me when I don't know what this cell phone is supposed to do or what this thing called the internet really is? Is there someone who can help me with that level of my reintegration and reentry? So that's one of the things that are not expensive. It's not, you don't have to go to your legislators to solve it. You just have to open your doors and your hearts and your minds to this community and be as welcoming as your spirit allows. I would encourage that. And now I'd love to hear from anything that you all can share with me about what you're doing or what you've seen. And, you know, I think that that's a rich conversation for all of us.
This is John Adams from Atlanta Friends Meeting. My wife and my family and I are just really completing a year of what we call ministry, where we brought a ex-offender into our home.
That sounds so good.
And it was started out around a family member of mine who was ill in my home, and he was an extended friend of the family and started helping us with this family member. And after she passed, he kind of didn't want to leave, and then he kind of just confided and told us that he was having problems readjusting. And we prayed about it, and we mindfully made a decision to let him stay and give him a year. And we just ended the year, and in that time, it was just like you said, it was more a lot of camaraderie. But he also was able to get enrolled in technical school, get re-registered as a voter, and get 1 year of that technical school education behind him. He already was a mechanic and had those mechanical skills, and we just helped him take a life inventory and enabled him to try to just jump out into the world and begin to come up with a written plan. And one thing was very interesting about the culture was you could tell that he had spent a lot of time
while being incarcerated, coming up with ideas about what he could do. So he was not short on ideas, but he did not have the skills of planning and applying, testing and retesting and reapplying.
Gotcha. And how's he doing?
He's doing great. I haven't heard from him this week, but he's doing good. I got to return the call.
I want to venture to guess that you're missing him.
We are. Yeah, my wife and I talk about it every day.
Okay. Thank you for doing that. Any other examples of your community helping people reenter or reintegrate?
When we had the convicted sex offender in at University Meeting in Seattle, we set up a support committee for him that functioned on and off for 10 years. It was mostly emotional support, but that getting that emotional support allowed him to address all the other issues that he faced. You know, feeling that he had someone at least who understood his problems, and that strengthened him to be able to address them.
Makes sense, yeah. And he's doing okay?
He is doing great.
Oh, better than okay.
Yeah.
Anyone else? All right, well, I'm certainly able to share some of the other things that I've seen that are very pointed reentry challenges and how communities of faith have been helpful. There is a Christian community up. I'm sorry, someone want to be heard? Oh, okay. The Riverside Church in Upper Manhattan, I have a strong affiliation with, and they started a program called Coming Home, which is a unique mix of that, you know, general welcoming environment. But they also spend time with the men and women who are in the program addressing some of the basic needs and helping them satisfy them, right? So they meet for dinner twice a week, and they do what anybody else would do at dinner. They talk about world events and the challenges that they face that are not unique to coming home from prison. But then they spend another 2 days a week in a very intensive, how do we make sure that you're going to find a job? How do we make sure that you're going to have adequate housing? So they have about 15 participants, and it runs for about 6 months. So they do it twice a year. And they spend those 6 months welcoming the people into the faith community, into the individual participants' lives. And then they also spend time with the very basic needs being met. So that's one that I would certainly lift up. And if anyone has any desire of learning more about that, if you contact me either through Greg or directly, I can certainly help you learn how they do that, and maybe you can bring it to your faith community. That would be one. There's a lot of opportunity to challenge your political leaders to revisit the laws in your state or in your community around reentry. And, you know, is it necessary to have that box? And if it is necessary, how should the box be used? In New York City, we recently revisited that box when you have to check whether or not you've been convicted when applying for a job. And now the law in New York City is that an employer cannot ask you the question of your conviction history until they offer you a job. So they have to make an initial offer first, and then in the process of finalizing that offer, they have the right to act. And they can only rescind the offer if the conviction is related to the job. So that's something that took a lot of work, both grassroots and legislative lobbying, to move forward. I think all of us have the ability to talk to our legislators and, you know, bring them the perspective that says, yeah, we all deserve and need that second chance, and why are we making it so hard for people to reenter? Do we really want a 60% recidivism rate? Shouldn't we have in place mechanisms that will decrease that need to look outside of law-abiding activities to feed yourself, house yourself, or take care of your family. So, you know, there is some political work that can be done. There's offering jobs if you are in a position where you have hiring power at your company or you have some influence. You know, maybe have those conversations with the Human Resources Department about how do we address the issue of people with felony convictions, and if we're not being as thoughtful as we can about their opportunities for a second chance, you know, maybe I can guide us in a new direction. If you are a property owner and you have the option of renting an apartment, you know, just how open are you and your friends in the industry to giving a set of keys to someone who's lived in a prison cell for the last 20 years? These are all things that I think we all can do, and I dare say must do, because the truth of the matter is, too many of us have sat on our hands for the last 30 years allowing millions and millions of people to go into this criminal justice system. And, you know, 95% of the people that enter a prison come out. So there is a responsibility to not only be prepared for that, but also to understand that they wouldn't be in that predicament if we weren't so complacent over the last 30 years in allowing this mass incarceration to occur. So I often use the word challenge, but I don't think that's what I'm calling it today. I would welcome your energies around successful reentry for the millions of men and women who are going to be coming into your communities over the next 10, 15 years. I'm sorry?
I have someone's clearing their throat.
Oh. So, you know, we've had about 10 minutes, I think, Greg. I would love to hear any feedback on this conversation, anything that you hoped we had talked about that we haven't. And if I can squeeze it in, or we can squeeze it in the next 10 minutes, we will. But if we get shut off before I get this opportunity, I just want to thank you all for spending an hour on a Thursday evening with me. Not often people want
to
do that.
I wanted to thank you. And my question is, how do we get rid of the prison industrial complex, the privatization of the prisons?
Did I say I would answer these questions in the last 10 minutes? Oh, my.
Yeah, and no.
Before we get into the theory of this stuff, can I just read and land? I've been doing this for 18 years, and I have to tell you, if you want to get something done, you cannot do it with your meeting. You have to do it on your own. It is very difficult. I mean, maybe it's the size of the meeting. We can't even get BDS approved in our meeting because somebody thinks that's violent.
That's another conversation.
Yes. I'm just saying, you know, a good friend of mine said, if you want something done, don't ask. So for those of you that are entrepreneurs like me, you can find allies in the African-American community. You can find people who are, there are ways you can go to your political parties and meet African-Americans. And after years of working with them and not being, you know, letting other people be in charge, you can develop trust, because the African-American community is looking for allies. They've just been burned so badly that they're very distrustful, and the bar is much higher before you trust it. Also, if you want to start a program, like our program, we've changed to, we have a program called Uplifting People here that helps people with reentry. And we're finding that we're going to have to create our own employment agency to find jobs, because the employment agencies discriminate.
Yeah, they discriminate, yeah.
The staffing agencies discriminate, and staffing is, in fact, companies are using staffing agencies to get around OEO for even other groups that have been able to find jobs.
I think that
we really think out of the box. We're not going to change that system. It's $1 billion a year just in Georgia. And that's just the Department of Corrections budget. And I'm not going to change that, at least not in my lifetime. So what I say
is, I think you're right.
Empower people, teach them the skills that we have. You're right, we need to listen to them. They know what to do. and we just have to help them overcome the obstacles.
Yeah, and it can be done on the individual basis. You can befriend someone coming home without having the whole meeting buy in, and, you know, just do what you can do. I think you're absolutely right.
And one place to meet, look for an AVP group.
AVP is so helpful, yeah.
They know people who have been in prison, who are coming out of prison. Quakers started it. There are lots of people there. Hang out and hang out with them, and you'll meet people.
That's so true. Yeah.
If I may, too.
Go ahead, Greg.
Sorry, I just wanted to jump in and offer that AFSC Friends Relations, if any of you were on previous calls, many of you have heard about the Quaker Social Change Ministry pilot program, but two of the aims of that program, of several, are to empower smaller groups within a meeting that do have clearness on an issue they would like to work on, to not have to wait for the entire meeting to come to a sense of the meeting to support that issue, but rather kind of be allowed by the meeting to work on it as a smaller group within the meeting. And we have 5 pilot groups, and we're hoping to continue that program. And I have lots of materials if folks would like to see it, because also the other thing is that it is flexible, but it does come from doing one-on-one accompaniment, specifically with undocumented folks in the Denver area. That's kind of where the model came from, and it would be very applicable to accompanying returning citizens, because having a small group within your meeting to process, you know, doing the hard work of accompaniment would be really valuable. So I'll be sending out some info about that.
Oh, that's great. And I don't want the question of how do we end the prison-industrial complex to go unanswered, although it inevitably will. The truth of the matter, in my opinion, is, you know, you cut it at its knees. You take the profit out. But somehow I think we've got to figure out a way to make prisons too costly to keep going, right? Not for the taxpayer, but for the people who are currently profiting. Figure out a way to take out the benefit. How we do that is certainly not going to happen or be figured out in 6 minutes, but whenever you think about this, you know, look at where the profits are. And if you can find a way to minimize those profits, if not end them, then I promise you we won't have 2.4 million people in our prison cells. I think.
Thank you. Yeah, okay. That's the hope. Yeah. Well, I'm wondering if we maybe have just one more question from maybe someone who hasn't spoken yet before we wrap up the call.
Okay.
Don't forget to unmute yourself in case you happen to try to be speaking.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Okay, thank you. I'm not sure about the Star 7. I don't think it's working. But,
you're not alone.
Yes. I just wondered, is there any basis? It seems like there would be a basis to even reach the Supreme Court on some of this, especially the disenfranchisement, or any of it, really. It's very discriminatory. Has there been any attempt to go? We talked about the individual level, but to go that route?
There has, and specifically around felon disenfranchisement. And there are 2 cases that I am directly aware of that did get to the Supreme Court on the issue, and the Supreme Court was very clear in both cases in denying the challenge that the Voting Rights Act does not extend to felons. That's been the pat answer. The NAACP Legal Defense Fund brought a case, Hayden versus Pataki, a New York case, to the U.S. Supreme Court in 1996, I believe, and that was the response. And about 2 years ago, the ACLU brought a case, and a different court came up with the same logic, for lack of a better word, that the Voting Rights Act does not extend to people who have felony convictions, and therefore they don't have that constitutional right.
Not following the logic, but I'll have to look into it. It seems the state of affairs, especially now, the numbers. And
you would think, right?
How,
yeah,
that if anyone needs a representative on their side, it's this group of people. So, you know, I'm kind of stunned. That especially, I mean, even when they're in prison, but especially when they get paroled, that they lose the rights to vote. It's just mind-boggling to me. But
if Greg can facilitate it, the first case I lifted up, Hayden versus Pataki, the named plaintiff is a colleague of mine, Joseph Hayden. And if you ever want to find out, he actually sued for the right to vote while incarcerated in New York. And he would be more than happy to tell you what that process was. And he was in the courtroom. They actually brought him down from the prison for the hearing at the Supreme Court. And, if you want to kind of understand what the arguments were on his behalf by the NAACP and others, I'm sure he'd be happy to share that with you. So if that's desired, Greg, I'm sure you can facilitate a contact with me.
Yeah, that'd be wonderful.
Thank you.
Well, before we go, Lewis, I think you and I would get in some big trouble if we didn't at least mention the Quaker Network and mass incarceration.
Uh-oh.
I know it's
you would get
kind of in it.
I would blame you. Okay. Go for it.
Well, I just want to say that the Quaker Network to End Mass Incarceration is kind of in a, time of coming to fruition where it's building itself out. The website that we've been working on diligently is soon to be finished. We're looking to create a new steering committee that's more representative of all the folks working on this issue and impacted by this issue. And I do hope that you will join at least the website and consider joining the network if this issue is passionate to you, and we'll be sending out information, especially when the website is ready, for those who are SVP'd. I don't know if you want to add anything to that, Lewis, but...
Okay, we're out of the woods now. You did it. Good.
All right, there we go. Fulfilled
thank
our
you for that,
duties.
Yes.
Well, I wanted to say, Lewis, thank you so much.
It's been a pleasure.
Conversation. I know everyone here has really benefited. Just really appreciate taking an hour out of your Thursday night to speak with us and engage in conversation. And thank you for all the incredible work you do every day.
Well, it's all for what I believe to be a necessary cause, so it's not work. It's
thank you.
Well, thank you all for caring enough to deal with my voice for an hour. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you all.
Thank you.
Okay, be well, all, please.